Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game. I'm Kevin Day and he is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, normally I try to do a little witty topical comment at the top of the show, but we're recording this on Wednesday evening and the news of Maradona's death came through about an hour ago, so it doesn't feel appropriate. My favourite football photograph ever is the one of him surrounded by nine Belgian players, and I think if anybody ever doubts the impact that one footballer can have on a city, they just need to go to Naples, which still to this day is pretty much a giant shrine to the memory of Diego Maradona.
Yes, I mean, he's the only player I've ever seen in football that has come close to winning a World Cup single-handed and to win a major league single-handed as he did in Naples. An absolutely incredible footballer. And I think that's what you have to assess him on first and foremost. I owe him a lot because I was doing my final accounting exams in 1986. And when he knocked England out of the World Cup, I'd been watching all the football, not doing any revision before then. I went back to doing a bit of work and then qualified as an accountant 3 weeks later on the back of that. So I do owe him a wee bit of thanks. But as a footballer, I've never seen anybody of his talent.
Do you know what, Kieran? I was wondering today when news came through whether you had any sort of relationship with Diego Maradona, just casually. And it turns out that tribute is probably the one that he would like the most. Well, indirectly, he's responsible for you being an accountant.
That's right. He was a fantastically talented individual. We all know that he had flaws. He was one of South America's greatest exports, and he unfortunately had a bit of a problem with another of South America's most famous exports as well.
That's a very elegant way of putting it. Now, Kieran, later in the show, we will hear from Billy Taylor, who is the communications chief at Millwall. And if you listen hard enough, you can just hear producer Guy laughing in the background at me being in a Millwall Brighton sandwich. but it's news day, Kieran, and boy, have we got news for you. And the first story is about another small footballer whose passing probably won't be as mourned nearly half as much as Diego Maradona, because Gordon Taylor has announced that he will no longer be head of the PFA. Is this unexpected, and will the PFA save a lot of money by not paying his successor anywhere near as much?
Gordon Taylor did commission, or his body commissioned, a report into the governance of the PFA. I believe that now is now complete. That investigation is complete. He will go down in memory as a guy who, at the age of 75, was trousering £2 million a year for being a union leader, and I think that will taint the perception of him. In terms of what he did for his members, all he had to do was that when the initial Sky TV deals were signed with the Premier League, the PFA said, well, we want a percentage of that. And the initial deals were worth, 40 or 50 million pounds. They're now worth 5 billion. And when the Premier League said, well, any chance of reducing the percentage that goes to the PFA, Gordon would simply say, no, we've got a contract, we've got an agreement, and if you don't like it, our members will ballot for strike action. So he did look after the members. It wasn't a huge job that he had to do in terms of those negotiations. Did he stay on too long? I think there are those people that will say that. You can understand that. Perhaps he didn't move with the times. The PFA does an awful lot of good work, and that shouldn't be forgotten. I've got the list of all the activities that they fund. I've taught footballers and retired footballers whose courses have been paid for by the PFA. So there's plenty of good people there. There's plenty of good work. Gordon Taylor has certainly not helped himself at times. And unfortunately, I think he'll be remembered for the wrong reasons rather than the positive things that he did. A person with flaws, and perhaps he hung on to power for too long. But we see that in many aspects of people at the top of football. There's too many old guys in charge.
Yeah, let's face it, Kieran. In 15 years' time, people will be saying that about this podcast. It's like, come on, boys, really, you should have patted. And well done for using the word trousering as well, because we know that Guy listens half-heartedly to this before he edits it, and with his leaning back on his chair, fanning himself with banknotes. But as soon as you heard that word trousering, you would have sat up and gone, do I need to phone a lawyer for this? And just as another little bit of insight into this podcast and how Kieran's mind works, I'm sure he won't mind. I could ask him. He's literally on the other end of a Zoom call. Kieran, you won't mind me saying that your WhatsApp, you were genuinely excited to tell me that the official receivers report into Macclesfield had just appeared in your inbox last night. It's like, got a message because it's got, who's this texting me at this time of night? It's Kieran. Oh, he's got the Macclesfield official receivers report. So is this feels like the end of the underlining, the final T has been crossed and I has been dotted now in this sad story, is it?
Yes, yes. You know, Macclesfield Town Football Club Limited is no more. The official receiver's job was to liquidate all of the assets. The good thing was that the ground itself was sold for I think it was £300,000 to the Phoenix Club. As we know, Robbie Savage is involved with that. He's taking on the coaching, and I think I've seen Robbie Savage on the TV on a few occasions in the last couple of days, and he's conducted himself superbly. You know, for again, he's a pantomime villain, but as somebody that's had the pleasure to, because I used to, you know, obviously I was living in Manchester, I'd often catch the train back from Brighton home games, and he'd be on them as well because he was coming out of the BT studios. So he was always very engaging, very funny, and he's a lot smarter than people give him credit for. So, Macclesfield is no more. The creditors were substantial. They will be getting some money, perhaps, you know, 20 pence in the pound. Ultimately, a combination of an owner who will, I think, we'll get nominated for our top 10 wrong-uns of 2020. And the EFL death of a thousand cuts approach in terms of getting rid of Macclesfield from the EFL, that didn't help the club either. But I think Macclesfield Town were going to go regardless of whether they'd stayed in the league or not.
And you were excited by that appearing in your inbox. And I was genuinely excited at the news that fans will be allowed into grounds in some areas of England, depending on which tier they're in, which is very, very good news, Kieran, but very, very short notice as well, isn't it, to arrange this for some clubs. And we will talk about this specifically, what it means for Millwall, when we chat to Billy later on. But this is good news, but it is very quick, isn't it?
It is. Clubs from the 2nd of December will be available, will be allowed, if they are in Tier 1, to have a maximum of the lower of 4,000 fans or 50% of their capacity.
Yeah.
So that does seem a little bit incongruous that you can have, you know, Spurs' capacity 62,000, we've got Old Trafford 76 and so on. So, you know, to have 4,000 fans, or if you're in Tier 2, it drops to 2,000. Yeah. And if you're in Tier 3, none at all. People are going to be rattling around. And I've got to be honest, Premier League clubs will be losing money from having that, because by the time you open up the turnstiles, employ the stewards, go through your COVID protocols and compliance procedures, the money from having, you know, 2,000 people turning up paying an average of, let's say, 25 quid a pop by the time you take out VAT, that's not a lot of money being generated. It's far better, however, for the clubs in League One and League Two, because those clubs are more dependent upon matchday income to begin with. The Premier League clubs will go along with it because they see this as a stepping stone, that if things work out, and, you know, clearly the speed at which the adoption and the availability of the vaccine is crucial here to football clubs, that 4,000 can hopefully be doubled and then doubled again as we process through the season. And it has taken everybody by surprise. I was one of those people that thought, oh, I'm just going to write off 2020-21. Can't see any improvements. But the vaccine news over the course of the last 7 days has been totally positive, and we've got to celebrate on the back of that.
Yeah, my guess would be, as most people are reporting, that Southampton and Brighton may well be the only Premier League clubs that will be in Tier 1. The hope is that London clubs will be in Tier 2. Will there be any clubs, Kieran, to go, financially, it's just not cost-effective to open the stadium up? We won't get as much money on ticket sales as we need to spend on stewarding, COVID compliance, etc., and say, no, thank you, we're not taking you up on this? Or as you hinted there, do you think all clubs will do this regardless of their status?
I think all clubs will take up the option for maximum ticket sales. I think players will want it. You know, players, of course, football players don't go into that career to play in front of empty stadia. So clubs will take a long-term view. They will know that data will be going back as to the success. Remember, we had the pilot schemes, which were run by those EFL clubs in early September. Those clubs all lost money, but they were doing it for the greater good. And I think any club that operates in self-interest is being very, very short-sighted, because if it's not going to open up to 2,000 fans, then how can it go to government in a few weeks' time and say, well, you know, the contamination rate is falling, and therefore, I tell you what, we'll open for 10,000, but not for two. They'll be laughed at, and I think there'll be an awful lot of very pissed off club owners elsewhere if anybody takes that approach. You were talking about the very short period in which to organise, and that is one of my major concerns, that we've got many clubs in the lower leagues who have used the furlough for staff, perfectly understandably, but also, and this hasn't really been reported, there's been an awful lot of redundancies as well. So to recruit people, to give them the right training, to allow matches to take place in front of 2,000 or 4,000 people by next Wednesday, I think will be a challenge. There's another small issue in that there's lots of fixtures that are scheduled for the 1st of December, i.e. Tuesday night. Yeah. Are those going to be pushed back to the Wednesday? You can understand it from a club's point of view. I'm sure the EFL will be as flexible as they can, but it's turning a corner. It's not the corner. It's not the end, but it's the start of the end. And we're all hoping. And when the news came through, I was A, surprised, and B, quietly delighted. Of course, the big bun fight is going to be who's going to get those 2,000 and 4,000 tickets.
Yeah, that's an issue that we raised with Billy at Millwall. So Billy at Millwall makes him sound far less impressive than the communications director at Millwall, basically, which is what he is. I want to talk about Scotland and COVID in a minute, but we're talking about the Premier League, because Daniel Levy has basically warned, and it sounded like a warning the way he said it, that if Spurs can't get the stadium full by the end of the season, i.e. they want 62,000 people back, because if he says if that doesn't happen, the club will lose £150 million, which seems like an enormous amount of money, but that's what he's claiming.
And I think his comments are accurate as well. Spurs mysteriously announced their financial results a couple of days ago. Normally Spurs leave it to the end of March. So when these came out, it involved a ridiculous turnaround. Spurs went from being the most profitable club in the Premier League. They made a profit of £87 million in 2019 to a £68 million loss in 2020. And that was just with 3 months of COVID impacting upon their finances. I think it's a real tragedy for Spurs, because for the first time, they have become the leading club in terms of generating match day income. They used to be far behind. You think about the old White Hart Lane capacity, 34,000-35,000. The new White Hart Lane is a creation which is designed to empty wallets And it's very, very good at doing that. So season ticket prices are quite steep in many of the areas of the stadium. But they overtook Manchester United despite having a smaller capacity. And part of the reason for that is you're charging premium prices because it's a new stadium, you're paying a London premium and things of that nature, but an amazing turnaround financially. And now sort of they got the worst of both worlds. They've got this amazing stadium, which they had to go and borrow. If you take a look at their results, they now owe, sort of they've got a net debt of around about £700 million. They're paying £800 grand a week in interest charges on various borrowings. So it was absolutely essential that Spurs had money coming in through the stadium, which was designed to be a 365-day-a-year stadium terms of hospitality, tours, things of this nature, all of which were very lucrative, thought through extremely well. And like so many other businesses, they've been impacted negatively. So Daniel Levy's comments, I think, are his numbers are correct. He's had to take a pay cut. He earned £7 million in 2019. He had to get by in 2020 with just under £3 million. So I think the Price of Football GoFundMe campaign for Daniel starts today.
Yeah, let's not forget Daniel Levy when we're talking about the victims of this terrible, terrible pandemic, Kieran. Palace obviously have got the distinction of being the first club to lose twice at the new White Hart Lane Stadium, which takes some doing for a stadium that's been opened about a week. I still can't get over the fact that we got searched by three different dogs. Now, I presume one was explosives and one was drugs, but no one was able to work out what the third dog was doing. Basically, we think he might have been a random dog who was just taking advantage of the situation. But in Scotland, none of this is an option, Kieran. There's going to be no football returning anytime soon in Scotland by the look of things. And the SFA said this week that they are set to lose £100 million because of the pandemic, which I think probably throws into sharp distinction how much Tottenham are actually worth when that one club is claiming to lose £50 million more than the whole of Scottish football.
Yes, and I think it's also a reflection of the size of the Premier League as a brand and these incredible TV deals that have been signed and the incredible commercial deals that have been signed. So Scottish football is brilliant in so many ways. And unfortunately, they really suffer as a result of COVID because Scotland has the highest proportion of revenue coming from ticket sales of any of UEFA's, I think, 55, 56 members. So if you take a look at Rangers, 60% of Rangers' income is coming from ticket sales. That compares to the Premier League, where it's just 13%. So for fans of clubs in Scotland to not be able to see the teams that they support it's bad for fans, but it's hitting clubs disproportionately worse. I mean, the one good thing I've always observed about Scottish football is that there are far fewer, or should that be far less? No, far fewer casino clubs, the ones who spin the roulette wheel, overspend in trying to get promotion and trophies and things of that nature. So at least that they were in a stronger position broadly overall pre-COVID compared to English clubs.
Yeah, sorry, you distract me. I'm trying to fewer less. This is something my father-in-law is very keen on. If it's got an S at the end, then it's fewer, isn't it, basically? Okay. It's less snow, fewer snowflakes, I believe. I may have that wrong.
But snowflakes is an S at the end.
So less snow, fewer snowflakes.
Okay.
Fewer casino clubs is correct. Less casino clubs is not correct. So there you go. See, that's the takeaway people get from this podcast: financial information and throwaway grammatical things, which I believe by sheer coincidence you'll also get in the interview with Billy Taylor. I know for a fact because it only happened a while ago and we had a similar discussion about imply and infer. We really are middle-aged, aren't we? Extraordinary scenes. A friend of mine, Kieran, Dave Ricketts, who listens to this, Gloucester-based Leeds United fan, His catchphrase is pretty much extraordinary scene. So I'm very much enjoying being able to appropriate it and say extraordinary scenes after the Liverpool Leicester game on Sunday night when Sky chose for some reason not to show Jurgen Klopp's very angry interview, where he basically spent his whole time venting his anger at the way all TV broadcasters were scheduling games. He also annoyed every Palace fan by pretty much saying we might as well send Brighton the 3 points now with the schedule that we've got. But, I mean, it was an incredible, incredible outburst, Kieran, and he's got a valid point. I mean, it seems from what he was saying that he's not the only Premier League football manager that feels this way.
No, we've seen Pep Guardiola comment similarly, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as well, in respect of, you know, we are recording this on Wednesday night. Liverpool have probably just about kicked off, so they're going to finish the match tonight at, you know, 9, 10 o'clock. The players will then have to warm down. They will get home midnight, 1 a.m. They won't be training tomorrow. You know, or if the most they'll do is go in for a massage. On Friday, they will have to travel down to Brighton for a match, which has been chosen by BT Sport for the 12:30 kickoff. And I think Jurgen Klopp, who always looks after the interests and represents the interests of his players as individuals, as human beings. You know, we see footballers as highly paid individuals, as commodities, but they're not. They're young men. They're professional athletes. And therefore, they should be given sufficient recovery time between matches. This is an ongoing issue. It's been exacerbated by the season starting late. So practically every Wednesday is now tied up in terms of European fixtures or the Carabao Cup or internationals. So players are being expected to play twice a week. And I know some people are going to turn around and say, well, you know, for 100 grand a week, I'd play football twice a week. But it's not playing football because, you know, the football that, you know, you and I did grow up with was blokes playing football. Now they are elite athletes. Mm. Sports science is important. The ability to plan for the next match is important and things of this nature. And Liverpool are not being given the opportunity to do this. And the same has applied for Manchester United and other clubs and so on. So there is an element of sympathy there. The opposite view is Sky and BT have paid a huge amount of money to broadcast the matches, and he who pays the piper calls the tune, and they are calling the tune. I've seen one of the we do get weird things arriving in our inboxes, and somebody sent me, I think it was somebody from the Premier League, sent me a copy of the TV deal and how it's organized and who gets first picks, second picks, third picks for each week. And that's why it's been so successful at generating revenue, because the deals are very attractive to the broadcasters. Are BT going to turn round and say, well, you know, we know that we get good ratings for Brighton versus Liverpool this weekend, but they're also, Liverpool also playing on the Wednesday night. So I tell you what, instead, and I've not checked the fixture, who are you playing this weekend?
Well, that's another issue, because Roy Hodgson is quietly unhappy about the fact that we played at 5:30 on Monday and are now playing at 8 o'clock on Friday against Newcastle, where Newcastle played their game early on Saturday, so they've had two more days rest. So it isn't just Klopp that's angry about this, quite clearly. But just on that issue of the he who pays the piper calls the tune, there's a friend of the show, one of our loyal listeners, is somebody who's involved in football at club level and at broadcasting level, and a very high level. I was going to use the word level. I was trying not to use the word level again there, Kieran, but I couldn't help myself. And of course, he wouldn't like us to name him, but he's basically saying that Klopp's been slightly disingenuous about this, because he knows that the 12:30 kickoff time is one that's most popular in the Far East, for example. And despite losing the China deal, quite a considerable amount of money is still paid by Far Eastern countries for Premier League rights. And it's kind of basically saying, as you said, it goes with the territory, and it's up to the club to manage it. And that's, I don't agree with that view, but I understand why somebody involved in football and broadcasting would say that. We all know the rules at the start of the season, and the fact is, if you're the manager of Liverpool, you're going to have to expect more demands on your club than the manager of Crystal Palace, Brighton and Burnley are.
Yes, yeah, I can understand that. There have been, I think we are living in a unique season on so many levels. Pre-season was curtailed. It was very much shortened. Players didn't get a proper rest at the end of last season. And I know, say, people say, well, hold on, didn't they have a break between March and June? But they didn't have a proper break. They were all training every day indoors under lockdown themselves. So the players are not at full fitness. Therefore, they are more susceptible to injury. If you pile more matches into a shorter period of time, we will see an increase in the number of injuries, and that certainly has been the case. You throw into the mix, we've also got players now contracting COVID. Hopefully not too many of them, but as you know from your own experience. Indeed. on Monday night, and I wouldn't say I was as gutted about the result as you are, but I've got to be honest, Burnley are a relegation rival of Brighton this season. So, under normal circumstances, Kevin, I'd be wanting Palace to win as much as I'd like to be in the middle of a Steve Dale and Anne Widdecombe sandwich. But it was I was going, oh, come on, Palace, at least get a point.
I know. Don't start me on that, really. My own theory is that we deliberately missed those chances, because getting into Europe next season, it's not worth it. Everybody will be in Europe next season when lockdown finishes. The flights will be so expensive. We'll wait till next season. But I am going to ask Guy to clip that bit of you saying, normally I want Palace to win. And we're going to play that at the start of every podcast from now on, Kieran. And I also had the thought, basically, when they are human beings, these footballers, as you say, they are athletes, and you can't ask them to play a game of football three or four times a week any more than you can ask you, Kieran, to do a podcast every day, or two or three. That the Jurgen Klopp post-match interview is freely available on social media, and I would urge people to watch it, because, to be fair to him, he wears his heart on his sleeve, and the emotion comes out. And also hearing Jeff Shreves being a bit baffled is actually very funny. But post-match interviews, Kieran, are something we probably take for granted as football fans, but they're normally quite carefully choreographed. And that was just one of the things we learned in a chat with Billy Taylor, who's Director of Communications at Millwall, who, to my obvious disappointment, turned out to be a thoroughly decent and interesting chap.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Billy, thank you for joining us on The Price of Football. I believe you are one of football's youngest communications directors. Tell us how you came into that role at Millwall.
Thank you for having me, guys, and thanks for that. I'm not sure how accurate that is, but I'll take it nonetheless. I've been at Millwall pretty much the entirety of my proper career. Up to this point. I did a degree in marketing at Bournemouth University. That was a sandwich course. So I did a year in industry at Dagenham, which was actually a bit more journalistic than it was marketing. And that just kind of gave me into football, and then managed to get the job at Millwall as programme editor when I came out of uni. And then I've tried to work as hard as I could since then, and I find myself in the position that I'm in now.
Yeah, I used to do a column for the Palace programme, and I had some very interesting discussions with the editor of the programme, mainly along the lines of, why can't I say that?
Yeah, it was that was a good time, and that was a good introduction, because it was part of it. That was at the start, really, of the digital and social media boom. So initially I covered the programme, and then kind of gradually had to take on the social media platforms, Facebook and Twitter, as they really launched. And since then, it's been kind of just, it's almost like we've got a different platform every 6 months to try and integrate into what we're doing.
And now, we try very hard to be positive here in The Price of Football, Billy. So I want to get the inevitable negative question out of the way about the pandemic, and then concentrate on some of the really good things that Millwall are doing for their fans and their community. How has the last 6 months changed things for you specifically as a communications director?
It's been really difficult. As it has been obviously all other clubs, but just speaking from our own experiences, it's been a real challenge. Not having fans here, obviously financially, has been extremely difficult for the club. The different logistical headaches that have been created by trying to get fans back in at reduced numbers under new regulations has been tough. We've had some good moments where we're kind of on the cusp of it happening, and then that have it taken away, and there's different headaches that's caused us. In terms of my role, we've tried to be as open as we can be with the fans throughout, and that's the challenge around that has been mainly because there's been times we don't know the information ourselves.
Yeah.
And we're really at the behest of the government or the football's governing bodies a lot of the time. And unfortunately, the reality is the way that this pandemic has played out, a lot of information has been in the public domain before it has reached us. And we can't really comment or act upon it until it reaches us officially. And that's been frustrating at times because, we've been ready to have fans back in here for a long time. Going back a few months now, we kind of went back on sale with season tickets in order to build those numbers back up, and also to help the club financially at a really imperative time. Then that was taken away from us, and it's kind of, the comms around managing that situation, because that was in the space of a couple of days, which was really, particularly difficult. We've tried to be open and honest with the fans. We've tried to communicate with them regularly without being sort of overbearing and sort of just coming out with statements which don't really say anything, which I'm not a fan of. So it's been a massive learning curve from start to finish, and hopefully, fingers crossed, thankfully, we're coming out the other side of it.
Yeah, because you, Millwall as a club, feel very strongly about fan engagement. I mean, you've got a fan engagement officer, which is brilliant. And I guess it's very difficult to engage with fans when fans aren't allowed to be where they want to be, isn't it?
Yeah, obviously everything goes online. So, Shona Groves, as our support liaison officer, has done a brilliant job in the past 6 to 7 months. You know, we've had fan queries, on an array of matters, really. Obviously, season ticket sales, general ticketing inquiries. Yeah. Refunds, streaming codes, the technical problems associated with all of those things. And it's not just Shona, it's the ticketing team generally that have done a great job in managing those queries, which have been, it's thousands and thousands of people all invested in every decision you make. And you have to respect the fact that they need the information. If they've got an issue, they need that sorting out. So we've got a great team of staff here who do as good a job as they possibly can do in that regard. And it's been challenging.
The good news is, though, Billy, fingers crossed, if London comes out of lockdown in tier two, which the mayor Sadiq Khan says he's expecting, you could have 2,000 fans in the new den quite soon. And presumably managing that will be a challenge as well, particularly from your point of view, because then you've got to communicate to the other 14,000 fans who'd like to be there why they can't be there.
Yeah, well, the way that we've gone about this is we sold kind of pre-lockdown, and for the first few weeks of the initial lockdown, we was on sale with season tickets, and we sold, I forget the exact figures, but we sold X amount. We went back on sale with season tickets a few months ago. Unfortunately, we had to suspend them fairly quickly because the sort of carrot of fans coming back was taken away from us. So we ended up with 3,000 season ticket holders for this current campaign. So our view is that those fans naturally have got absolute priority. And if it's two, if it is 2,000, then obviously we've got to squeeze those 3,000 into two, which is, it's obviously not going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult. So logistically, we've got to find a way around it. And that's kind of what we're working through at the moment. We're trying to come up with different solutions for different scenarios. And ultimately, this is really a pathway. We're hopefully starting with at least 2,000, and then we might go into tier one later down the line, which means 4,000. Then we've got to find a way to fill 1,000 more seats. So it's, you know, after so much time with no fans, it's a nice headache to have trying to get fans in. And obviously demand is going to far outweigh supply. That's the problem. And we need to find a way to make sure that we're able to speak to the fans that can come efficiently, because we need to provide them with a lot of information, because everything they've been used to is going to be different to what they come back to.
Yeah, and you're going to find a lot of local pubs, I guess, who are providing a full restaurant service as well, just so they can open on match day, aren't they? Have you found, Billy, that fans have generally been sympathetic towards the club's plight? As I know, talking to CEOs and owners of other clubs, I know what football fans are like, because I am one. Sometimes you can't do right for doing wrong. It's very difficult to please all the fans all the time, isn't it?
It is, and I think that's a perfect summary. Obviously, there's been times where we may have got things wrong. We've done we really have done the best job we possibly can. And I know the word unprecedented has been completely overused for the best part of this year. The fans largely have been absolutely brilliant. Everything that we've done has, pretty much, been met with the response, listen, the club are doing the best they can in ridiculously difficult circumstances. We appreciate what they're doing. We understand that, we're not going to be completely satisfied with everything, but we understand that it's also a difficult time and they're doing all they can. Really, that's been good. And I think generally in football, and maybe in society to an extent, that there has been that kind of rallying together, certainly in the early part of the pandemic and the first lockdown. And fans have just been, our fans, I can only speak really for them. They've been absolutely terrific towards the football club.
Yeah, just to bring Kieran in here for a moment. I mean, psychologically, Kieran, it's fantastic news that fans will be allowed back into the Championship. But League One, League Two level, it's crucial that these fans are allowed back now. And it's crucial that they continue to be allowed back, because the worst thing that can happen, I imagine, Kieran, is that you say to a club in League Two, right, you can have 2,000 fans, and then 2 weeks later you're saying it's not working, you can't anymore.
Very, very much so. And I think there's special challenges for those clubs in League One and Two, because they've got to make their grounds COVID compliant. And I was talking to somebody from a League One club in the last 24 hours, and he said, well, we've put a lot of staff into furlough. We've had to make people redundant, and now we've got effectively a week potentially to do everything that's required in order to be able to host a match next Wednesday. But we will do it, because we will work 24/7 if we have to. But it's good for the fans, because it gives them something to look forward to. It's actually good for the players, because you don't become a professional footballer to play in an empty stadium. And from the financial perspective, clubs won't be making a lot of money. Billy would probably have seen some of the sums at Millwall, but with 2,000 people, by the time you've paid for the stewarding, by the time you've paid to make the new den COVID compliant, there's not a lot left. But it's a step forwards, because as Billy rightly said, 2,000 can hopefully become 4,000, and then as the vaccine starts to roll out, we'll be looking to increase that by increments over
Billy,
the course
come the
of
glorious
the rest
day
of the season.
When we're all allowed back into stadia again. I think our listeners would like to know what match day is for you on a normal match day when you've got a full new den. You must be extremely, because you're not just talking to Millwall fans, you're talking to media and fans all over the world, aren't you, I'm guessing?
Yeah, so my role really on match days has changed over the years. When I first started, it was kind of juggling different platform stuff we had to update over the course of the game. Thankfully, over time, I've built what I see as a really good team alongside me, who would do a brilliant job in managing those channels. So these days, I kind of take on a more observational role. My focus on match days is to really look after media obligations of mainly the manager, but any players after the game. So I'll watch the matches from, in normal circumstances, from the tunnel. That gives me a good feel for, obviously at the moment, how Gary Rowett is feeling during the course of the game. that really helps me post-match. I think that's crucial for my role. I need to understand how the manager is feeling post-match, because that dictates everything that happens from that point.
Yeah,
I know how to approach him. I know how to discuss the game or any briefings or incidents with him. So that's, you know, that's really it. And then post-match, I take Gary round and just go through all of his obligations. I'll brief him if I need to brief him on anything. Thankfully, that's not necessary all the time. And we'll have a little chat about what we think we might want to say on certain topics or about certain players or injuries or whatever's happened during the course of the game. And then once we've finished, we go down to his office and have a tiny little debrief if necessary after that.
I've been at quite a lot of grounds when games are finished, and I've witnessed the communications officer, press officer, whatever they're called at each club, having to guide the manager through the hierarchy of, you know, TV broadcasters, radio broadcasters, written press, local press. I don't think people fully understand. For a manager who's just watched his team win, lose, draw, perform brilliantly, and otherwise, they have to do this dance, don't they, really? And I've seen certain managers, let's use Neil Warnock as an example, because nobody will be surprised that he's the example, who don't really want to do that, but have to do so, don't they? They really can't just turn around to the press and say, lads, I'm not in the mood. Girls, I'm not in the mood. I'm not doing this. And you have to guide them through it. And I imagine that's not always easy, is it?
No, not always. Obviously, you know, results and performances dictate their mood after games. Most managers will be exactly the same as that. They have to do it as part of the job. You know, they quickly become used to it. I think for new managers, it is a bit of a shock because there is so much to contend with, particularly after games when, you know, for the most part, even after wins, emotions are running high. And I think what's difficult is that the manager can do maybe up to 8 interviews after a game, probably at championship level, once you've got through the radios and TV and then all the written press as well as club media. And every sentence they say is heavily scrutinised by those who watch it or watch it, hear it or read it. And I think it's quite difficult to be speaking for the best part of probably an hour and to say everything completely spot on as you want it. That's just, you know, particularly when you're emotional. Some managers are much better than others. And Gary, thankfully, is very, very good to work with. He's very astute. He knows clearly what he wants to say, how he wants to communicate, you know, with the media and obviously with the fans as a consequence of that discussion. So and generally, I think throughout my time at Mill, I've been very lucky.
Yeah, it's not just the fans and the manager you sort of look after as well, because I think it's fair to say Millwall's community work is exemplary, pretty much, isn't it? Millwall does a fantastic job in its local community, doesn't it?
We really try our best, yeah, and yeah, absolutely, we pride ourselves on that. The community trust has undergone a little bit of a restructure in the past couple of years. Sean Daly's come in as the CEO and has done an excellent job of really refocusing everything. You know, different strategies going on, different initiatives and projects being driven. And they, you know, clubs, including ourselves, talk about the work of our community trusts and quite rightly, because they're very important, but it's not really until you see the impact at a human level that you can really appreciate just how much of a difference it makes. And I'm fortunate in that I can see that. I can see a participant on a program and how the work of the trust, the opportunity given to that person by the trust, has changed his or her life for whatever reason. And that is a really nice part of this job, seeing that and telling that story.
Yeah. As a proud Londoner, Billy, proud South Londoner, I'm always arguing that people outside the capital don't necessarily appreciate the problems that many communities have in London. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, possibly so. I think the landscape of London, you'll know as well as anyone, is changing all the time. I think certainly in the local borough surrounding the Den over the past 30, 40 years has changed significantly. You know, that presents different challenges for different reasons, really. Over the past few decades, what we've seen here is that our core support was based locally, which is the case, I think, probably at most clubs in working class areas. Those individuals maybe moved slightly further afield. You've got to still market to those people. You've got to understand how to get them to games regularly despite living further out. So there's different challenges it presents, but I know exactly what you mean.
Has social media, Billy, made your job harder or easier, would you say?
That's a great question.
It's Kieran's. Thank you.
No, it's a really good question. It depends on the circumstance, really. I think, you know, pretty much throughout my career, social media has been present. I think in the last few years, it's really, you know, it's blown up. And I think it's, you know, for the most of society who use technology, social media is the way that they are predominantly consuming media.
Yeah.
I think even when they're at home watching TV, I don't know what you guys are like, but I'm still on my phone on social media when I'm watching TV. And I think that's the way that people do consume different media has changed over the years. I think it depends on the circumstance, really. Post-match after a defeat, I'm not really looking at social media. But when we announce a sign-in, I can't wait to look at social media.
Sure.
What it's created is a real, like, desperate thirst for instantaneous information all the time. And whether that's news of a transfer or about an injury or whatever it is, people feel that they need that information right now. And that, you know, that has to influence what you do as a club. In previous years, fans would have to wait till the next day to read a paper to understand what's happened with something at a ground or a transfer or whatever it is. But nowadays, Cubs need to act quickly to satisfy that demand. So definitely good and bad.
Well, because I'm guessing as well, but it must be harder for you to control stories because they appear on Twitter or Instagram from a multitude of sources, and fans, like myself included, tend to believe anything that they're told on social media. And it's like I find myself, I can't help it. I try not to, CPFC News Now is one of the many things. And you, for example, during the summer, there was on this Palace News website thing that I'm scrolling down, and it says, Club Insider says Palace should have sold Zahar, he's not worth the money. And I literally said, what idiot said that? And it turned out it was me they were quoting. Because they'd listened to a podcast, and what I'd actually said is the pandemic means it's now a buyer's market and we won't get as much money for Wilf if we sold him as we would have done beforehand. And that turns into this story that fans believe. And I'm the same, I believe it. And that must be really hard for you because 10, 15 years ago, you would have been controlling a story, really. You'd have been you that released it and you could change the narrative of it. And you can't do that now, can you?
No, it's obviously increasingly difficult year after year to do exactly that, to try and control the message or the narrative. I think particularly in recent seasons, the sort of social media boom has seen the birth of the ITK, those who claim to be in the know. And more often than not, they are absolutely not in the know, believe me. But I think because fans and not just talking about our fans, I think football fans generally are so desperate, as I was alluding to earlier, for that nugget of information, that they're more inclined to believe someone for saying something just because they've said it. They've put their head above the parapet and they've said it, but they don't know what they're talking about. And I think because there's, as I say, that first information all the time, there's lots of pressures on clubs, journalists, agents to kind of get information out there. And that's why it's impossible not to secure a transfer about it leaking out on social media. It just doesn't happen. So you have to accept that. So what we try to do here is manage it as best as we can. We appreciate that fans are desperate to know the latest goings on. More often than not, we can't tell them exactly what's going on. Obviously, certainly not on an official basis. But we do what we can to just try and shape the message as best as possible, which is challenging, believe me.
I've not come across that ITK before. I think that's a really good expression. There's a bloke who drinks in the pub that we go to before games, whose mate knows the brother of Martin Kelly's driver. So of course that means he knows everything that's going on at the club. And I go, well, it must be right. His mate knows the brother of Martin Kelly's driver. And it's ludicrous what you will believe if you're told by somebody on social media. Now, on a more upbeat note, Billy, I live in Norbury and there's a studio I go to quite a lot in London Bridge. And the train takes me past your ground, but it could be taking me past a much bigger stadium in future because you've had a very long-running saga around the freehold ownership of the land at the grounds on. That's been resolved recently, has it? And you've got plans for a really swanky new stadium, haven't you?
Yeah, so this has been a long-running issue which precedes my time at the club. It's dating back I think 14, 15 years or so now. Came to a head a couple of years ago with a little bit of dispute with the council. Fans were terrific in helping the club essentially get what it needed to get out of that predicament. We find ourselves in a better position. Obviously, COVID has sort of slowed the progress of that. But yeah, we've got what we think are really positive and exciting plans for the future of the stadium. You know, we hope to be able to move those forward in the near rather than long-term future. But it is, regardless of that, it's a long-term project anyway. It's, you know, with a view to us progressing on and off the pitch over the course of the next X amount of years. But we have ambitions, and I think we're right to have ambitions, because if you don't, I think you just stand still, and I think that's not good for anyone.
And Kieran, economically, yeah, the uncertainty over the future of the land where the ground is on, that disappearing can only help in terms of getting investors, sponsors, future plans, can't it?
Indeed. If you look at it from a club's point of view, you've got your three sources of income. Millwall have got a hardcore fan base, but that can potentially grow. And then you can start to use these horrible words such as monetize that. You know, Billy's been inferring that there has been a change in the demographics in terms of the locality around Millwall. So there are new businesses there. I think they'd like to be associated with an improved stadium and things of that nature. So that's going to help your commercial income. And that goes into the budget for the manager. So it can become
a virtuous
circle.
I'm going to channel my father-in-law here, Kieran, God rest his soul, and say Billy's been implying, you infer, just so we know. So you'll notice, Billy, that Kieran and I have been married for far too long. Finally, Billy, on the pitch, you've lost a little bit of momentum with three successive draws, but you're very much in the promotion shake-up. You've got a progressive manager. You're playing some really good football, and it pains me to say that. Are you dreaming of that massive workload promotion to the Premier League will bring? Because that, you really won't know where you are work-wise, really. You're going to have... It's going to be brilliantly, beautifully busy, isn't it, if you do get promoted?
Yeah, it would be. I wouldn't mind whenever it comes, and hopefully it does come sooner rather than later. Yeah, we know that as a club in the Championship, we're largely punching above our weight most seasons. But I think as a club, we need to try to change that narrative, because if we keep believing that we're lucky just to be competing at this level, we're a small club in the Championship, that's not really going to take us to where we want to go, which is ultimately to the Premier League. We know that in terms of budgets, we are one of the smaller clubs, but that's not to say that we can't compete above the constraints of our own budget. And I think that's certainly what Gary's working towards, changing us from a team that scraps and scrapes in the Championship to one which can compete regularly at the sort of upper echelons of the division. And I think we're making good progress in that front. Yeah, we've drawn the last three games. We're struggling just a little bit in front of goal at the moment. A couple of injuries to key personnel, but there's a really good group of players here who can grind out results. Loads of togetherness, camaraderie in the squad, and that, believe me, goes a long way to being successful at this level.
And also it makes your life easier, I would imagine. If you've got a squad that generally likes each other and gets on with each other, that's good for you, isn't it? I mean, it means you don't have to worry about players' rivalries spilling out onto social media. You know you can concentrate on other stuff, knowing that the players want to play for each other and for the manager.
Yeah, absolutely right. It's not always been the case. Going back a few years, it wasn't nowhere near as good as what it is now. Since really Neil Harris took over as manager, when it was 4 or 5 years ago now, and Gary's kind of continued it, the characters in the group are excellent. Every one of the players is a great lad. There's no bad eggs in the squad whatsoever, and of course that helps us do our jobs. And I think that really translates not just what happens on the pitch, but what happens around the training ground day to day, the way that the players deal with staff. It really is an excellent club to be at. Always has been, but especially at the moment, with the way things are, it's very, very positive.
Billy, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It's always good to get insight from somebody who works at a proper football club. And it's great. And again, if there's anything we can help you publicise in future, please let us know and we'll do so. And let's keep our fingers crossed that 2,000 fans it's coming into will grow into 14,000 and a full house in the Premier League, mate. All the best to you.
You're very kind. Thanks for having me, guys.
That was, I found that a really fascinating interview, Kieran. And what, you know how proud I am of London and being a Londoner, especially being a South Londoner. And people don't always associate London football clubs with community, but Billy's pride in Millwall really shone through there, didn't it?
Yes, yeah, he was superb. I thought he was a fantastic ambassador for the club. Mm. He explains where they are and the fact that they're living in a changing London landscape. Absolutely, but they mustn't forget their roots. And you know, as somebody that was born in the Elephant and Castle, I was absolutely chuffed to hear him say what he said. You know, my Uncle Terry would be smiling in his grave listening to that.
Yeah, we're not entirely sure if he is dead or on the run yet, are we? There's still some dispute about that. Two other Championship clubs in the news, Kieran, Middlesbrough and, drum roll, Derby.
Yay!
we're going to have to put a stake through the heart of this story because it just keeps coming back, doesn't it? Just when you think it's gone. The EFL has published the appeals panel decision in relation to the row between these two clubs.
Yes, this was really weird. For those people not familiar, Derby County were charged by the EFL in respect of two issues. First of all, the sale of Pride Park at £81 million. And the EFL said, well, we don't think it's worth that. And it was purely, and the accusation effectively was purely done to make a profit to comply with financial fair play or profitability and sustainability rules, as they are now known. Derby successfully defended that, and their view that if you go and put a sliding roof over Pride Park, all of a sudden it will become a multi-function, multi-use stadium, and therefore the value of £81 million was valid. Well, that was successfully defended. And at the same time, Middlesbrough owner Steve Gibson, he was absolutely livid that in his view, Derby County had got away with selling the stadium in the first place, yeah, and this transaction shouldn't have gone through. So he was trying to claim that Middlesbrough were entitled to compensation because in the year that this transaction went through, when potentially Derby could have had a points deduction, Middlesbrough missed out on a playoff place. And he said, well, if we'd been successful in the playoffs, we would have got through to the Premier League. So therefore, it's cost us, you know, millions and millions. So there's a lot of conjecture there. So this went to Sports Resolutions, who are the sort of the ACAS of football disputes domestically. And they found in favour of the EFL and Derby in the sense that Middlesbrough, it wasn't their fight to get involved with. Yeah. And therefore, to claim that they were entitled to compensation, that was an invalid claim. I mean, it's a bit awkward because it's very much a case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. On this particular scenario, the EFL and Derby were both singing from the same hymn sheet. The EFL said, well, you know, we lost in terms of the value of the stadium, so you know, we've just got to accept it, and therefore you should do that to Middlesbrough. And Steve Gibson going, well, I still don't believe that it's worth £81 million, and you know, he's I don't know who's going to support him on that. At the same time, the EFL are appealing another one of the verdicts where Derby was successful in respect of our good friend amortization and the unique way in which Derby do their calculations. There's nothing wrong with being slightly different. This one purely coincidentally reduced Derby's losses by £30 million in the three seasons of the assessment period, which just so happened to ensure that they complied with the profitability and sustainability limits and therefore avoided a points deduction. So we've got, on the one hand, the EFL effectively being on the same side of Derby. At the same time, they're trying to get them, they're charging Derby. And to make matters very intriguing, as we say, we're recording this on Wednesday night. Who are Middlesbrough playing at home tonight in the northeast? They're playing Derby County. So you can imagine the levels of frost in the director's box as we speak.
Yeah, luckily it's a quite a big stadium and they have to social distance. I think they might be socially distancing quite a bit further than they need to. And well done for saying purely coincidentally there, Kieran, as well. I'm sure our lawyer will be entirely happy with that. He'll nod that through. That should be fine legally. Purely coincidentally, he said that, didn't he? Image rights, Kieran. Image rights is a subject we've often discussed on this show, particularly as a way for players to be paid outside their wages. But Zlatan Ibrahimovic this week has called for an investigation into the game FIFA 21, alleging that EA Sports, and I quote, used his name and his face without permission. Now, I understand, Kieran, that your face has occasionally been used without permission, but is Zlatan going to earn money out of this, do you think? Has he got a case?
Well, this case is intriguing, and I think we did actually discuss it briefly in August. Mm. It is to do with image rights. Apparently, there's an organisation called FIFPRO, FIFPRO, yeah, which is sort of the union of players' unions. It represents PFA and all of the other unions around the world. And they appear to have sold players' likenesses to EA Sports and some other organisations to allow the players to appear in FIFA 21 with a likeness, with the right name on the back of the shirt and so on. Because if you've ever played some other, and you know, I'm sure people remember some of the old school video games where you would have players' names like Marabona or something like that. You know, very, very, very slightly different. You're going, well, he's wearing a blue and white stripe with a number 10 on it, and he's got curly hair. Yeah. No, that name is nothing. So they always used to be slightly different, but now, because of the level of competition between EA Sports, who own FIFA 21, and Konami, who own Pro Evolution Soccer, they're always trying to get one up on each other. And of course, then you've got the likes of Sports Interactive, who own Football Manager, which Football Manager 21 has just come out. That's a plug there. If anybody from Sports Interactive is listening and wants to send me a game purely for inspection purposes, you've got my address, gang. Does Zlatan Ibrahimovic have a case here? My understanding is that it's remote. I believe that Gareth Bale has piled into this as well. Tom, our friend at the Football Law, I've seen his posts today on Twitter, and he seems to think that because FIFPRO have been acting on behalf of players' unions, it will be a challenge for Ibrahimovic to win this. You know, it's not that Zlatan needs the money. I think it's just a point of pride. Presumably, he didn't quite like the likeness, and therefore he's seen his arse with regards to this, and he's trying to get a few quid out of it.
Yeah, do you know what the world needs, Kieran? It needs a game called Football Accountant 21, doesn't it? And whereby you could make a lot of money by you and Swiss Ramble. Your face would be on the front of the box. I don't know if anyone knows what Swiss Ramble looks like, but his... Well, somehow he'd end up getting money out of it, Kieran, and we wouldn't, essentially, is what I'm saying. Now, this is a piece of news that Guy sent through that slightly baffled me. And you know, Kieran, my theory of professional laziness, because I like to be surprised by your answer as much as our listeners are, that the value of some MLS franchises in the US has been increasing astronomically. And I've been struggling and scratching my head to work out what that reason might be. So I'm looking forward to you elaborating.
In the MLS, the MLS has something called an expansion fee, i.e. if you want to buy a franchise for a new football club, you're going to have to go and pay money. Now, the cost of that has gone up from $100 million to $200 million just to buy in. So remember we were talking about Rob Reynolds and McElhenney buying Wrexham for 2 million quid. Well, we said at the time, yeah, that seems a bit weird. If it's going to cost you 200 million quid to buy a football club in the USA, you can see the appeal of a club such as Wrexham. Mm. But if you take a look at American football, you've got clubs such as the Seattle Sounders. You know, they are selling out their stadium. They're getting attendances of 40,000 a week. Okay. There is a wage cap operating in the MLS. There is no relegation, so you've got guaranteed revenues coming in, and the value of the TV deals pre-COVID, you know, we don't know what's going to happen post-COVID in anywhere, was ticking up. So Vincent Tan, who some people might remember from Cardiff City, he was the owner there. He owned 20% of Los Angeles FC, and he sold that for $140 million, wow, which valued that club at $700 million. You think, well, hold on, $700 million, yeah, that's what, fair, 550 million quid. That's almost twice what Mike Ashley is trying to get for Newcastle United, who have got 50,000 fans turning up every week. They're playing in the Premier League with the world's biggest TV deals. So, yeah, American investors seem to think there's a lot of upward potential, and that's what you're doing when you're buying a franchise. You don't care about what's happened in the last 5 years. You say, what do we think is going to happen in the short to medium term future? And that's why I'm prepared to pay these huge amounts.
And our final story, Kieran, the president of the Confederation of African Football is facing an ethics investigation.
Well, I think since this story broke, things have accelerated a wee bit. Ahmed Ahmed, who is the Madagascan football administrator who became head of the CAF, he is now being given a 5-year suspension from football from FIFA.
Oh, okay.
Now he's in the last hour, he's put in an appeal to say, you know, I'm squeaky clean. And looking at the charge sheet, which would even make Greg Clark look like a choir boy here, it's unusual contracts with sports equipment companies, allegation of bribes, the use of Confederation for African Football funds for personal use, and sexual harassment. Oh. So yeah, that's a pretty long rap sheet. So FIFA seemed very confident. They've done an investigation. If these charges are correct, then you know, I think a five year suspension from football is actually very mild.
It seems to be. Don't forget, I was going to say don't forget, Kieran, but you know this. Don't forget, listeners, if you'd like to support The Price of Football, you can by visiting supporter.acast.com/priceoffootball, or just click the link if you're listening in the Acast app. I would just like to thank everyone who has supported us so far, including Jasper Vestergaard, JS, Canary Carolyn, Pepe Loyola, Daniel Kay, Sutton Sadler, Liam Reynolds and the Mike, and special thanks to Martin Searle for his donation and tweets summarising every show, which always make me laugh. Yes. And Martin is a doctor and a Palace fan who drinks in the Pawson's Arms before games, and we are currently on the Pawson's Arms WhatsApp group trying to negotiate a bulk deal for him to vaccinate us all. Because we feel that if anybody can get us vaccinated before the rest of the world, Martin Searle can. Don't forget, our next pod will be, of course, on Monday. And that's our questions pod. If you have any questions for us about any aspect of football and finance, please get in touch with us. Questions@priceoffootball.com. And for once, I'm going to say this. Stay safe, everybody. We look forward to seeing you next time.
And thank you very much, folks, for all the reviews. If you do like the show, press that subscription button on the Apple icon. It does make a difference. We're not quite sure if you can give us a 5-star review if you're enjoying what we're doing. That's fantastic. It doesn't matter what you say. You can say you would rather it was presented by the Nolan sisters and Frankie Boyle. It makes no difference to where we are in terms of our egos, but it does make a difference to producer Guy when he's trying to sell the show to others, trying to persuade guests to come on. And you know, we were absolutely made up with Billy today. He was an absolute star. Millwall fans, you should be really proud to have such a good guy working at your club.
The Price of Football. The Price of Football.